to Idle Red Hands Weekly. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Lyle.
And what is Idle Red Hands Weekly? It is a wildly successful, crowd-funded project that takes viewers on a surprising sci-fi journey through various country and city landscapes, from small towns in Sweden and the deserts of Nevada to the bitter chill of Siberia, where children explore and engage with abandoned robots, vehicles, and machinery, large and small, while dinosaurs and other creatures wander our roads and fields. It is a stunning book of alternate nostalgia that mixes high-tech futurism with scenes from everyday Sweden. And that is... so that was the description, I think, from the Kickstarter of Tales from the Loop, the original art book. So the Simon's Solenhog.
So you lied to us again. It's not Idle Red Hands Weekly that is wildly successful. I thought you were just joking on your lies.
Right. That was why it was so hard to get it out.
So Tales from the Loop, now Amazon Prime.
Yeah, it's an Amazon series. I was really surprised, and things have kind of moved fast because they crowdfunded the original art books in 2015, and then the end of the following year, the RPG by Free League was December 2016, and then they've done a sequel to that and supported that game nicely. And another thing that's come up is to go along with this Amazon release is a board game. So now they're kickstarting a board game of Tales from the Loop, maybe to kind of catch anybody that wouldn't play an RPG, but is still geeky enough to enjoy that setting.
I mean, they're certainly out there, like in the board game cafes and that, and people want something where they don't have to invest as much time in. Yeah. So have you seen the series?
I did. I've watched the first 5 episodes. It was really surprising. The first episode I almost gave up on because I couldn't get my head around the setting. They call it Ohio, so it's the Midwest, but it looks like 1950s, 60s Sweden. It's really...
Yeah, I caught the first 10 or 15 minutes of it, and I was like, oh gosh, it's like watching a Swedish film from the 80s. And I was like, I'm not in a Swedish film from the 80s mood right now. So I was like, I'll come back to this because I've heard good things. So, but you recommend?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I definitely recommend it. It's very surprising. My first excitement about it was based on the idea that this will be good inspiration for role play sessions.
Right.
And I think it may be. Like, there's some of the ideas or some of the thinking that goes into some of the episodes will make for some interesting content or some suggestions that kind of lead you down, like playing with time or playing with different types of mechanics. I don't want to spoil anything in any of the episodes.
Right.
It caught me off guard. And each of the episodes is a really nice kind of twilight zone. And I really was surprised by that. I wasn't expecting that at all. And I guess that kind of, you know, to go along with the mystery of Tales from the Loop, it makes sense. But they seem to go away from the kids pretty fast. And it gets pretty adult. Like some of the themes are very intense. Hmm. So I was expecting kind of Swedish Goonies or something, you know, that was more along in the tone of Stranger Things.
Right.
Because that kind of pulls its punches and does kind of odd stuff. But this gets pretty intense. And it has some sexuality. It deals with death and has things that are a little bit, I think, more intense than I was expecting you would even get into in the RPG setting, but were definitely suggested in the art to the writer of the show.
And, were they suggested in the art? Okay.
Yeah, I think so. The melancholy.
Pretty tame or?
Well, it is, but I think the kind of sadness, like, you know, lot of the depictions of Sweden in winter, it's very desolate, and it's just like, you know, single tiny lights and things, and it really gets that across. I mean, there's a lot of kind of existential angst and kind of a questioning of, you know, existence in this that I really wasn't ready for, but by the third episode, I was in love with the tone.
Good.
But it did take me that long, though.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair enough. Like, there's some shows I'll watch, and you know, some people are like, oh, well, if it doesn't hook me in the first episode, I don't want to watch it. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, no, you got to give it some time. And there's definitely series out there. And I watched it and I go, yeah, this looks like you got to give it time. And I will give it that time, but got to finish off Legends of Tomorrow.
Oh, nice.
Which is a much, much different tone.
Yes. Yeah. So what have you been up to?
I started, as everybody is, an online game.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, no, we were supposed to. They were doing it face-to-face for about a year and a half, and then the coronavirus hit.
Yes.
And I joined just as they did their first online session of AD&D, first edition.
Excellent.
Yeah, we're playing, we're at the Village of Hamlet, part of the Temple of Elemental Evil.
Right, That's excellent. And so what are you using? What, like, virtual tabletop or what software are you guys using?
They're keeping it pretty big. We use Discord.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Maybe we'll get around to using Roll20, but it was just all Discord. Very much theater of the mind. It was a very talky session. There was no combat. We rolled a die or two, but we found like an online dice rolling thing. So that was sorted.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and because they were a little bit concerned because I guess they're very much an open group. All roles are done in the open. There's no DM screen to roll behind.
Okay.
So everybody rolls in the open, kind of keeping it all honest.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were setting it up, it was a variation of the, basically we roll 3d6 and to roll our stats, except, you know, we rolled 12 times instead of 6.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
And then you pick like the best 6 of the 12.
Right.
Yeah, so it's very, very old school, and even doing like using gold to level up. Like, not only do you, not only like, I guess, spend your experience points, but also spending gold to level up. So it's kind of become more of a, I don't want to say less heroic, but it's more mercenary.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they have like a trading company now.
Oh, nice.
Like, I've come in and they're like, oh, we got our business, and, you know, we've got our manager of our business, and, you know. So yeah, it's kind of neat. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's a real throwback. And that's what they wanted to do. They really wanted to capture what it was like to play first edition AD&D.
Right.
So they're really reluctant to like do house rules or anything like that. They just want, hey, we really want to experience in its pure form. Or, I mean, people who are original Dungeons & Dragons or whatever might balk at me saying AD&D is the purest form of Dungeons & Dragons. But, so yeah, it's neat. I'm the cleric because they needed a cleric. And, you know, actually that's a really good class to like sort yourself into a party, because if they don't have a healer, you're like, well, I can help you with your healer. You're in. Okay.
Right.
I cast a spell, like a guy was all still recovering from getting beaten up.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, what, you know, let me heal that face of yours.
Nice. So what is the biggest difference? Like, after you've played fifth edition D&D, so yep. what's the biggest difference for you? Like, where has D&D gone, and has it gone away from some things that you think were a mistake from the original form?
I think that there seems to be a, you know, although you, as you would say, like the later editions, you know, I only played the one session.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I got another session coming up on Sunday. Like, in character creation, it all depends on your game master, but if the game master is, hey, let's play by the rules,
mm-hmm.
then like encumbrance becomes really important. The way the weapons work is quite different.
Right.
Not only it's like, here's the damage you do, but your damage to do the different sizes, and then you flip over and here's the damage you do at different armor classes.
Mm-hmm.
So you're like, oh, you know, I really, this weapon and this weapon are almost the same. And then you flip over to the other chart and you're like, oh, okay, you get all these bonuses to hit,
mm-hmm.
depending on what other armor class is. Yeah, so that's, you know, a difference that I definitely had forgotten. But it almost seems like simpler, like the spells. I mean, you have a lot less spells to choose from the player's handbook. What abilities you have, like, let's say as a cleric, they don't have that every level you got to get something. You got to get a goodie. So it's actually more manageable, I guess, when you jump in as a cleric or any class, because you're like, oh, my abilities are kind of easy to understand.
Oh, that's good.
And they're not going to constantly be stacking on these abilities. It's like, I can turn undead.
Right.
So I guess you get less, but it's easier to grasp, I guess would be a way to put it. There's less bonuses to keep track of.
Oh, good.
So you know what I mean? So you get less, but then it's easier to grasp.
Yeah.
People might take, like the way it's written.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly in subsequent editions, I think they cleaned up the writing, and that's why I think a lot of these retro clone games like Old School Essentials and other games like that do really well, is because they clean up the wording.
I see. Yeah.
And the presentation of the rules.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after like decades of experience, they're like, okay, this is what this is supposed to do, or this is how you do this, and so this is the best way to word that.
Right.
Yeah, but it's shocking that, yeah, because fifth edition, they think, oh, we want to make it more user-friendly, but it's actually, I mean, there's more rules.
Yeah, yeah.
Really, in fifth edition than there is in first edition.
Yeah, that's really interesting, too, because, yeah, I think that was to try to get more people into the hobby, and I guess, you know, it's pretty much more popular than it's ever been. It is a more complicated, and especially if you're playing a spellcaster, you've got lists of things to go through and kind of decide what you're going to do.
Oh, yeah.
So that's.
But if you're a fighter, I mean, you're like, oh, eventually I'll get these special bonuses. But like, I remember when we played Starfinder,
mm-hmm.
and then we all started at 6th level.
Right.
And I wasn't like a new player of a role playing game, right? So I played all these other role playing games. But then we started at 6th level, and I was an operative.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, so many abilities, like, because you're calculating up to six levels worth of abilities. And I'm like, I don't even know what these abilities do.
Right.
So what's good? And so that's why when we reset, I said, can we just start at first level?
Mm-hmm.
So I can learn what it, and here I think you would start at 6th level and it would be, oh, okay. Yeah. Because there's not three different things at every level.
Right. Right.
You're getting like, oh, here's three new abilities, or here's stacking on there. Yeah.
Well, yeah, you'll have to keep us updated on that. Yeah, I'm really interested on how that's going, and definitely what, you know, how that feels compared to, you know, Pathfinder, modern Pathfinder and modern 5e.
Oh, definitely. Compared to third edition, you're going back to it. Again, the way the rules are worded, or like the wording could certainly be cleaned up. And like any role-playing game, even first edition, it's better if somebody teaches you how to play it. But you can certainly see how we as kids got into it, especially if you're looking at the box sets. Mm-hmm. Whereas like getting in at third edition or fifth edition, that's a lot of stuff to read through.
Right.
Yeah, and I was surprised because I went and got the print-on-demand AD&D books actually before this game, mm-hmm. but well before the game, but so I had them. I was shocked at how thin the player's handbook was.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Well, part of that is because a lot of the rules that are in the current player's handbook or the 5th edition player's handbook are in the Dungeon Master's Guide in 1st edition. But still, you're like looking at it, it's like, okay, and when you look at it, yeah, I guess this is all a player needs, really. Yeah, I got my abilities, my equipment, and...
Well, during this self-isolating time, I've been working on a lore video. So we just released the first part of the Mutant Chronicles. Yeah, so I'll put a link to that in the description. And
I think it's really good because, you know, I put a teaser on Twitter. Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh, if you don't know the Mutant Chronicles or what are the Mutant Chronicles, you'll see it. And somebody just joking around was like, oh, you mean like, you know, that they've got 3 or 4 editions and a miniatures game and a board game, you know, obviously joking that, hey, people know what the Mutant Chronicles are, but I don't think they necessarily do. You know, somebody who's a big fan will, mm-hmm. but even like Chris, who I wouldn't say he's a casual fan. I mean, I wouldn't say he's a fan, but he's aware of it. Mm-hmm. When he listened to your first, like when you were editing it, he was like, oh, where's this and this?
Right,
the stuff that he knew is much later in the history of the Mutant Chronicles. But there's a lot of interesting stuff building up to, you know, the demons, you know, the techno demons that come later.
Right.
Yeah, so I think people get a lot out of following that lore video and learning, hey, where did the corporations come from? And how did they end up colonizing the solar system? And why are they diesel punk now?
Exactly, yeah. I think that's a really fun part of the setting. And I think a good thing that Modiphius did is making the time periods more distinct and kind of letting you know what types of games you could actually play, like what types of settings these different mm-hmm. time periods in Mutant Chronicles are. And it gives you a lot of variety where I've read through the first and second edition and it is much more limited. I mean, basically you're playing, you know, Doom Troopers and Freelancers and that's it. And they really dug in a lot deeper to give you experience throughout the whole setting and also through the different time periods. So yeah, that'll be really fun to go through.
No, I like that. Like when certain game settings or they have this really rich history and then, hey, let's use all of it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, let's not just use this particular period and make references to the past, but like, hey, like, yeah, like you said, like Mutant Chronicles, they've set up the timeline where you can play at different periods of that timeline. And it reminds me, like Battletech has done that for a long time. It's like, you can play here, you can play here, and the timeline keeps advancing. So they can, of course, keep adding mechs and books and stuff like that. But they're giving you like really playable periods and they never discard the past. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, another famous IP that does that is 40K. Yeah, when they have the Horus Heresy and then they come up with the Horus Heresy games. And then you can play currently, and there's still different periods that you can play in. And Black Library is showing you like how the Inquisitors could play or the Rogue Traders.
Yeah, I think that's the only thing that, well, a few things, but one of the big things that Mutant Chronicles was lacking is that huge support. I think there were a few novels and comics based on that setting, but they didn't have the kind of Black Library level of support of what you could do in that setting, the stories that could be told. So you had a little bit of fiction in the RPG books.
Right.
And then a couple of novels, like maybe 2 or 3 novels, and then a limited series of like 4 comics were printed. They didn't give you kind of that rich lore to choose from. So it's fun to go through this and kind of piece things together. Biggest difficulty that I've had so far is being really careful about not spoiling things, because even the book itself says this is GM only information. And so I want to like go through the setting, but I don't want to lay things out that may actually ruin it if you play. So I'm trying to give, you know, what the players would know and what people need to be familiar with the setting. But there's so much interesting detail about what's going on behind the scenes and how the corporations are actually the espionage and things that are going on. And I'm going to kind of hint at that, and then maybe do like specific videos focused on some of those things. But for the most part, I want to keep it broad enough that someone can casually listen to it and enjoy, but not have it ruined, you know, any of the surprises that may come up when you're actually playing the setting.
Well, I mean, you could have like that standard lore, but then also mm-hmm. have, I don't know, GM secrets or Brotherhood secrets, or, you know, you do like when somebody clicks on like a corporation, like a Bauhaus or a Capital video, it's really clear that, hey, this is all the dirt of Capital. So, you know, check with your GM.
Right, right.
But I think, yeah, people, you know, a lot of people don't play these games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just read the books and listen to YouTube videos or buy the books and put them on their shelves. So, I mean, they might just enjoy reading it. And even if you spoil something, but you're making them more interested or more apt to engage with the game, then, I mean, that's worth it.
Oh, yeah. No, that's very true.
It's better than them kind of like, oh, that was okay.
Right, right. But a little vague.
Where was the juicy stuff?
Yeah,
and right. It's like, yeah, you know.
Right. No, that's a good point. Yeah, and the timing of this lore series for us is fun because there was just news recently that Res Nova, a company that I think they've only had one previously published game that was around last year at the cons. Yeah, I think so. It's some Dungeon Slayer, I think. I have to double check, but yeah, I think Dungeon Slayer.
Yeah.
So they have the license to produce a new edition of Warzone.
Mm-hmm.
And this was revealed on a vlog of I think his channel is like the Professional Geek or Professional Nerd. And so he's working in the games industry as a freelancer. And he talks about kind of what's going on with his day-to-day, like how his hobby is going, and then also how his work is going. And he previously worked on a kind of related skirmish level miniatures game that Kaman produced.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's got experience with those systems, and he's a very big fan of the Mutant Chronicles and specifically Warzone. He was in tournaments and organized things like with Warzone, so he's familiar with the setting and is going to be their guy for maybe getting the system going and getting the lore all put together and up to date. So I'll put a link.
That's
to
good.
Yeah, I'll put a link to his video. The only thing I'm worried about, just like previous iteration, which was Warzone Resurrection, that Protos Games did, was a Polish developer, a Polish studio.
Yeah,
they kind of, you know, they had their own take on Warzone, and it made it look much more G.I. Joe, and they didn't really go heavy into the lore. People were excited about it because they liked that property, they liked that setting, but I don't think they really did it justice. I mean, a lot of people have different opinions about it, but the models looked, you know, they weren't kind of heroic scale and kind of, you know, big shoulder pads and heavy looking. They were much more refined, much more modern military, and it took a lot of the flavor out of the setting. And then they ended up just dropping I think they lost the license basically. And so they just dropped it kind of mid development. So that's a little disappointing. So I'm really hoping that Res Nova has the funding, has the backing, has the strength to actually develop this IP and make it something good and hopefully work with a good publisher, hopefully work with a big publisher.
Yeah, I didn't see these miniatures, but I got to tell you, like, some of the old Mutant Chronicles miniatures were a bit too clunky.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Like some of the Brotherhood ones, you're like, ah, he sounds really awesome. Wow, no thanks. it looks like a five squares put together.
Right. So you're Diss and Heartbreaker there, 90s.
I mean, some of them are, I mean, what was it, the Venusian Marshal?
Mm-hmm.
That was really good. Although maybe the horse could have been a bit bigger. It was kind of like he's on a pony.
Oh, right. Well, that's right.
But that iconic image was amazing. Yeah, I guess my concern would be like a miniatures games take a lot of capital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And card game takes a lot less capital to make.
Mm-hmm.
They probably would have to kickstart it to get it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then it's buyer beware.
Right, right. I think that's what's happening because that was their previous game was a Kickstarter. So I believe they're going to take this to Kickstarter and gauge the support or gauge the interest in it.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, that they have that because Modiphius has the Siege of the Citadel license.
Right. Yeah.
And I know they definitely try, when somebody has an IP, they'll definitely try to like divide it up into as many different parts as they can. Mm-hmm. So you can certainly see somebody getting the miniatures license.
Right.
And then somebody else getting the role-playing license. That board game, though, is like right in between. And I mean, they're making their own miniatures for this board game.
Right, right. No, that's really true. And that was an odd thing when the RPG, the 2D20 third edition, was released by Modiphius. They actually listed, you know, on their webpage, miniatures. I think they were resin miniatures. And maybe those were actually Protos sculpts that they had done because they looked very similar to the kind of thin and human proportions of the Protos work. So there's been a couple of attempts to kind of, you know, bring back miniatures. And you're right, though. They've already, for Siege of the Citadel, they've already done so many. I mean, they've done so many of the major characters and major types of troops that it seems a little difficult and redundant to now another company's going to go back and do new sculpts and then have those all reissued. I mean, there weren't specific unit types. It's mostly named characters, you know, for Siege of the Citadel.
But yeah, but yeah. No, but you saying that makes me think, wow, this is even more mammoth than your typical miniatures game, because it's not like you can roll out two factions.
Yes, that's true.
For, I mean, you could. I mean, they could come up with a, like, they could do something like the Blood Berets versus the Dark Legion. Boom. That's our initial, it's a skirmish level box set for this. And if it's successful, then we'll roll out other things, which would be a lot smarter than promising the world and delivering nothing. Right. But yeah, we got so many factions. I mean, for each faction, how many different sculpts are you going to need? How many different molds are you going to need to invest in?
Yeah.
Like for a miniatures game, you're going to need, I don't know, four, five, six for each faction? I don't know. Like,
The developer that was talking on YouTube was saying that their approach is going to be to kind of spread the time periods out and to start it early and do a skirmish level game. So I think this initial first Kickstarter and what they're going to come out with first is going to be small numbers, you know, maybe 10, 12 models on the table. So a skirmish level to kind of fit the flavor of early Dark Symmetry or, you know, previous, you know, not quite the Dark Legion era that original Warzone was based in.
Yeah.
So to break things down a little bit. And that might be a good approach, because then they can build on that. If they actually can do it well, the rules are good, people want to play it, then they can build up kind of to the army level.
I mean, you said about the Doom Troopers, but maybe that's the way to go.
Because
you have Doom Troopers versus Dark Legion. Boom.
Right.
That could be the way to go. But even there, you'd have to have at least one big demon, some legionnaires, and I mean maybe three Dark Legion sculpts. Yeah, I'm excited, but
cautiously. Yeah, because it just hasn't been done well since, and even at the time, I mean, you know, the Target games had trouble and you know, ended up folding and leaving things where they were, and that's an interesting thing that I've noticed reading through the Mutant Chronicles and Warzone lore is it is a little bit of a time capsule, and Modiphius did a nice job updating things, but because they kind of went out of business in the 90s and didn't continue to develop and kind of take the setting more seriously like Games Workshop did with 40K, it still has that flavor and that fun. It feels like Doom, or it feels like one of those 90s, you know, video games. I like that very much about it, and I hope that at least with a new version of Warzone, a new edition of Warzone, they can capture some of that, because I think as much as I love Games Workshop lore and its setting, it does take itself really seriously, and that does kind of contaminate fan base a little bit. They're a little bit gatekeepy and a little bit vicious to people that aren't up on everything. And I like the fact that Mutant Chronicles is still, it kind of ended at that level where it still is, you know, has some satire and has some kind of parody in it that still makes it a fun setting. Yeah, so we'll see how they deal with that. Speaking of 40K fans, do you follow Henry Cavill on Instagram?
Do I? No, I don't. No disrespect to Henry Cavill. He's a fine actor.
But recently he had a post on Instagram, and it was a little stealth. The way he did this was a little stealth, but the image and what he was writing about mostly were not related. So his message in the post was, you know, thanking health workers and talking about the current pandemic situation and the risk that people are taking and hoping people stay safe and just admiring the heroic performance of doctors and nurses and people that are dealing with this. But the image of this post was him painting a Custodes helmet for Warhammer,
I saw that,
Warhammer 40K, right.
He calls it his almost lifelong hobby. One of my almost lifelong hobbies, and he generally can't get enough of the lore they have built over the decades.
Oh, nice.
A company called Gabe's Workshop, or Plastic Crap, as quote-unquote we call it.
Nice.
So yeah, I mean, she didn't know he was into 40K, but I knew he was into video games or computer games, because he told a story that he missed the call from Zack Snyder that he got the part in Man of Steel.
Because
he was playing World of Warcraft.
Wow.
So he was playing World of Warcraft, and the phone rang, and he's like, forget it. And he kept playing, and then called back whoever it was later, once he wrapped up his game. So yeah, I knew he was a gamer.
Right.
But I didn't know he was. And yeah, he's actually painting there. I mean, he's obviously not a competitive gamer if he's playing Custodes.
Right. So now there have been calls, I think mostly on Reddit, that he needs to be cast as the God Emperor of the Imperium. If they're making a 40K movie, then
I think the Emperor is, yeah, sure, but people are going to complain that they're whitewashing the Emperor, because I think he's from around Turkey.
Yeah, that's right.
So he's the impression I got that he's Turkish looking, or at least Middle Eastern looking.
Right.
Cavill's got black hair, but yeah, he's definitely not Middle Eastern looking.
Yeah, well, he plays a Witcher pretty convincingly, so maybe we can...
Oh, is the Witcher Middle Eastern?
No. I didn't know that. He's just a vampiric albino looking character. But
yeah. Oh, is that what you're saying Turkish people are?
he can play across hair types, I think.
Yeah, but he's really funny. I really like him in interviews. Mm-hmm. Here's an interesting anecdote of Henry Cavill. He met Russell Crowe when he was in boarding school.
Oh, wow.
Russell Crowe was making a movie, and one of the kid in that movie went to Henry Cavill's school, and Henry Cavill wanted to be an actor, so he went and talked to Russell Crowe. And then Russell Crowe sent him a care package because he kind of remembered him. He sent it to the other kid that he starred with.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent it, I'm going to send it to that kid I talked to.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then I guess they met later on when Cavill was an adult, and he's like, do you remember me? You sent me a letter. Russell Crowe was like, what did I say? And he's like, this. And he's like, yeah, it sounds like me. But, I mean, it's really great about this 40K, but now we're going to have to hear, did you know Henry Cavill's a gamer? Yeah. And Will Wheaton and Vin Diesel.
Right. We got to add him to the list of people that...
Actually, maybe with Cavill being a gamer, people can stop talking about Will Wheaton.
Yeah, that would
As be... if that was a surprise. Yeah. Right. So, did you know Will Wheaton was a gamer? No, really? did he read comic books too? Yeah. wait a minute, hold on. Are you telling me Will Wheaton's a nerd? Wait.
Yeah.
How does he hide it?
I mentioned Kaman or Siman or Kumini or not previously.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Siman?
Well, I've settled. They seem to, in all of their promotions now, be going with the Kaman pronunciation. And in previous episodes, I've been just the intonation that you have to use to talk
come
about.
On. Oh, yeah, I guess if you on. Do see. Apostrophe mon, they'd right. be like, come on,
right.
kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The whole thing seems like a come on, basically. But anyhow, they had some interesting news over this, and it may be kind of shutdown related. It may be, business related. But a real strange press release that they had is announcing that they have ceased trading. Come on is a public company on the Hong Kong mm-hmm. Stock Exchange. And recently they were suspended from trading, delaying releases. So they had an annual report that was coming up. And so they cited audit issues as something that was causing the suspension and causing them to delay their annual report. And it's very interesting and suspicious, and it's kind of matches with some of the suspicions that I had previously, especially with the odd Kickstarter that they ran that was all about kind of a garage sale version of getting everything out that they had previously done.
It was a Kickstarter, but it was like not really one project, but a
catch up on everything that they had previously done, and it had kind of a funky name, but it was really odd because they really live and die on Kickstarter, and they include so many. I mean, they have a really nice strategy that they get you in for $100, and then they bloat things up with optional buys, and then also the shipping to $300-$400 when all is said and done. So if you want to be taking advantage of everything and some stuff that you assume is exclusive to Kickstarter and will never be released retail and will not exist after the Kickstarter, they kind of showed their hand and revealed in that last kind of collective Kickstarter that everything still exists and they've got warehouses full of it and they need to get it out there. Yeah, that was a time machine. Yeah, so that Kickstarter is called Time Machine.
Yeah.
So go back in time and pledge for previous campaigns.
Boy, that would have been a huge red flag to call that. Like, I mean, there's something like Ulysses, mm-hmm. they do Torg, and they do their Torg Kickstarters, and it's like, hey, you can go back and get the previous box sets from the other Kickstarters,
right.
But it's all Torg, so it makes sense, right? So it's kind of like the same line, it's kind of, hey, that's a catch-up, but they're actually releasing new stuff, but to have something that's just like, hey, here's a Kickstarter for, I mean, that's, I don't want to say Ponzi scheme, but it's obviously that they're not keeping their capital.
Right.
They obviously need cash to come in. It's like the comic book industry where it's just collapsed practically.
Yeah.
After like two weeks of no constant cash coming in, it's like, okay, everybody put their pencils down.
Right. And Diamond's like, we give up. We're not doing this anymore.
Yeah. Diamond distributors it's going to take like 6 months for them to like repay people.
Yeah. Yeah. Putting everybody on a plan, a repayment plan. That they have any options. That was pretty amazing.
So because of the audit and the financial reporting irregularities,
So April 1st, there was a suspension of trading. And then they had two of their non-executive directors, independent non-executive directors, resign. So suspension of trading on April 1st, April 2nd, one resignation, April 3rd, the next resignation. And then 11th, Kaman issued an update of the situation to clarify kind of what's going on. It probably is that they have just gotten so deep into this Kickstarter addiction that they don't release anything directly to retail anymore, even if it's like a Marvel, they just did it like a chibi Marvel miniatures game, and that property went to Kickstarter. And Marvel doesn't seem like it doesn't seem like that IP would have trouble selling, you know, strictly at retail. So it does seem like they have kind of become addicted to having that money up front, spending it on things that they owed from previous situations, and then I just think with how expensive that license must have been, it was funny that they took that to Kickstarter as well.
Yeah, I mean, IPs, getting IPs and then doing Kickstarters, I mean, you got to be disciplined. Palladium, I'm not saying Palladium has got the best business sense or it runs the business very well, but it's been around for a while. Mm-hmm. And they just took an absolute bath on their Robotech miniatures Kickstarter.
Oh, right.
And they never even finished fulfilling it. I mean, and then there's like that Kickstarter I did. I won't name it. But clearly the person wasn't disciplined financially and spent all the money before things went to print and needed another company to come in and rescue that project. Mm-hmm. And it's only because they have that new cash, that person has that new cash coming in, that they're going to be able to, you know, years later fulfill this Kickstarter.
Right.
So yeah, they probably got really crazy mm-hmm. with all that money coming in from the initial Kickstarters, and then the rest of the product's not moving. And maybe that business model to be Kickstarter only. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you get a lot of money initially, mm-hmm. but then that's going to get worn away. You actually have to fulfill it and printing and shipping. And if there's miniatures, you got to do the miniatures, but then it's all the upfront costs. And then you need a steady, ready revenue stream after that. So you need to be able to, like, so where are you going to put this product?
Yeah, that's really, yeah. That's
great. And there's kind of a glut now of, back to ResNova. There's kind of a glut of these like miniatures games. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. yeah. So it's or miniatures board games and stuff like.
Yeah. And they had really, Kuman really started piling up the licenses too, because so of all the unfulfilled stuff that they have right now, the Marvel United, which is that chibi game, Bloodborne, mm-hmm. which is based on the video game, Night of the Living Dead, which is a kind of modified Zombicide using the George Romero property. And then also mm-hmm. the Trudvang Legends. So Trudvang was the Swedish RPG that they did a board game version for.
Okay, yeah.
So all of that stuff is backed up, but all of that stuff was licenses that they had to buy. So the only thing that they produced that's actually their own property was the second edition of Zombicide. So they're getting pretty far behind in stuff that they've had to pay, you know, quite a bit upfront. And probably this kind of, you know, production stoppage and everything that was going on prior to their trading suspension didn't help at all. So I think a lot of people are going to be, feeling that.
Oh yeah, and if it's all stacking up in the warehouse, I mean, we've seen it with was it One Ring?
Oh yeah.
And I think the Cubicle 7 were the ones that picked up the IP?
No, they're the ones that lost it. Free League picked it up.
Free League picked it up. Okay, great. And Cubicle 7 recently picked up 40K or something.
Yes, yeah, they got 40K, Age of Sigmar and Warhammer Fantasy, right? The whole
thing. So yeah, when you lose your IP, you're on a timer. Like there's something negotiated on that you can keep selling the product until a certain date, mm-hmm. and then you're just kind of stuck with it, I guess.
Yeah.
Or I guess do it through a third party, I suppose. And that there would be some accounting irregularities, but yeah.
Right. Yeah. So surprising with this news that they're rushing into another probably multi-million-dollar Kickstarter. So Kuman just listed Ankh, Gods of Egypt, which is a sequel to Blood Rage and Rising Sun. So it's it's that same sort of area control, heavy combat setting, like very setting rich combat game. So Blood Rage was, you know, Vikings and Ragnarok. Rising Sun was feudal Japan, and now Ankh is going to be the gods of Egypt. This is odd timing, because there's no guarantee when factories are going to be back to 100% in China, and they 100% rely on the production to happen in China for these games and this Kickstarter. And I guess they see the kind of flexibility of Kickstarter. I don't know if their terms have changed, but Kickstarter used to just be, best intentions and best effort, and if you can't do it, then, too bad, you know, that's, and so maybe they're going to rely on that if they're never going to get.
Well, I mean, you know, we do bag them, but as far as I know, they do fulfill
mm-hmm. yeah,
their Kickstarter. So it's not like they've not completed it like Palladium.
Yeah, only no, definitely.
Fulfilled half of a portion of their Kickstarter. Yeah.
Yeah. If they could have kept their eyes and stomach the same size, I think they could have really kept this model going, but they got, I think, a little greedy and started to put a lot of things in production that maybe, but you're right though, they've always been able to fulfill and it's maybe the past year that people have started to see delays.
Yeah, like you said, like they're rushing into it, and I sounds like they've built up a model where they need to consistently rush into new projects.
Mm-hmm.
And create, and yeah, I know you can do Kickstarters that do that are expansions and additions to previous things. But yeah, there seems to be their let's have a brand new game kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, they need to get them out. I mean,
yeah,
you need different revenue streams. And I mean, maybe Kickstarters just seems too easy.
Maybe. Yeah. It might be.
Yeah. Because it's like, here's your cash up front.
Mm-hmm.
And if, yeah. And there's another thing. If they're relying on cash up front in order to fund all their projects, I mean, I certainly understand that. But if that's the only way you can fund it, then that would be a bit of a concern.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I'm just criticizing the business side of things. The game, we play Blood Rage, right?
Yeah, both Blood Rage and Rising Sun. Yeah,
but I didn't play Rising Sun with you guys.
Yeah, those are both Eric Lang. Well, all three of these are going to be Eric Lang games.
Yeah.
So yeah, they're very playable and gorgeous minis. I mean, really great, nice detailed minis for a board game. It's like next level. So speaking of Kickstarters, this period of uncertainty is not putting a damper on people taking huge projects to Kickstarter. So we have Ankh, the Gods of Egypt, third in the trilogy of this style of game that they're doing. The Tales from the Loop board game is going into production. They might not have to rely so heavily on China. They may be producing, they may be doing printing in Europe. And it's a smaller scale. It's a board game, smaller scale board game. But also, the sequel to Gloomhaven. So Frosthaven. In Kickstarter too. So I'm really surprised. I was surprised to see that. And maybe the project's just been finished and it needs to get published. But I hope that he doesn't run into, because the developer of that game is really great. And his communication and everything during that original Gloomhaven campaign was excellent. He was a really good person to really reassured you that he had things under control and was really working hard on his project. And I really hope that this current situation doesn't make getting Frosthaven released any more difficult or cause any problems, because I hope his reputation isn't hurt, because he made a great game and this looks like it could be a really great sequel, but it's not a great time to rely on Chinese manufacturing or fulfillment or anything.
Yeah, no, I understand. I think I got an update from Clan Invasion, the BattleTech Clan Invasion, which, wildly successful Kickstarter, but lots and lots of new miniatures that are involved in there. And that's where they're getting the miniatures made, is in China. Mm-hmm. And I guess things are starting up again.
Oh, good.
Where they are, or wherever they're being produced. I don't know which province it is. And they said, but things are backlogged. So
yeah.
Things are slower, but they said they have started them up again. So things have been delayed, but they're confident that things will be going on. Just to get back to the Kickstarters, like I backed Monster, or is it Monsters Monsters? But it's the Tunnels and Trolls people, Flying Buffalo.
Nice.
Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons, I wanted to get the book, but also like to get it as a Kickstarter, because like, especially the smaller companies, I mean, this is a Kickstarter is a way for them to get cash.
Yeah.
In a time where, maybe all their distribution channels have kind of shut down.
Mm-hmm.
Like people aren't, in some parts of the United States, they're not allowed to buy non-essential stuff. So.
Right, right.
So that's a way to do it, or buying PDFs. I brought Old School Essentials.
Oh, nice.
The PDFs. I actually want the print books, but Necrotic Games has a really good system that they started in January. So before I think they realized that this would actually be needed. So people buy the PDFs, and then later on you can get like a discount.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the discount is what you spent on the PDF will be discounted from the print products.
Wow.
At the same. Yeah. So I thought, wow, that's great, because they had to shut down. They said we can't print any of our books right now. So we won't be able to sell our printed books, but hey, let me remind you of our PDF system.
That's great.
Yeah, so I bought the PDFs now, so they get a little money now, and then later on, when things are more back to normal, then I can upgrade to the print, and then I'll get more money. So.
That's great. Yeah, I think that's a really good system, and it definitely is going to help when things get back to normal. That then they're going to get orders. They're going to have orders coming in for things. So that's
great. Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, these Kickstarters, I mean, yeah, you could say, hey, like, why would you do it now? Because there's so much uncertainty. But I mean, if it depends where they are, like if they're if it's got miniatures, a lot of times those are like a year, 2 years out,
because
they're going to do the 3D imaging, and then they'll do the molds, and
right.
So there's a lot of steps before they get those miniatures made anyway. So I guess they figure it'll run its course, and we get some money in now. keep the company afloat.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope that proves. I just hope it doesn't ruin anybody. I mean, we don't know what Command's future is like. They're saying as a company, they're solid and this doesn't mean anything. But that's exactly what you would say if you were a publicly traded company that just got suspended. But
yeah, no, I mean, no. I mean, they're not solid financially. But I mean, they do produce some good games, but people should just be aware.
Yeah.
Like people could be, yeah, I mean, being delisted doesn't mean the company's going to go under. Mm-hmm. I mean, they still have their investors and they could still get more money through investors, just not through the stock market.
Right. Yeah. They just had an eyebrow raised in their direction. Wait a minute. How many Kickstarters have you run? Our current self-isolating period, this period of staying home, has meant a bit of a boom for virtual tabletops. So Fantasy Grounds just released their usage stats for over the beginning of the year so far, and they're up 150% on their virtual tabletop session. So, I mean, logically, that seems to follow that, you know, people can't get together, they can't meet, so they're finding alternative ways. And like you were saying, using Discord to be able to run role-playing sessions. But so we'll see. And we talked about last week all of the different options for virtual tabletop, and it seems like all of them are unlocking their premium features so that people get a chance, if they're going to try that, to see the full experience for free. And then they can slam the gates closed and start charging again. If you really liked it, then it might be something you're going to pay for that you wouldn't have even imagined paying monthly or buying a license for.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, some people could take the short view and they're like, hey, people are going to have to come to us right now, so let's not drive up the price, but keep the price as it is.
Right.
But some people are taking the longer view and they're like, hey, make it free. I think Marvel Unlimited has like a free month.
Oh, good.
Like you don't even have to sign up. You can just read, you know? So it's not like, hey, you're locked in and when your trial and you don't cancel, we'll start charging you kind of thing. It's just like, nah, you can just check it out for a month.
Nice. Yeah. So yeah, I hope everyone that's listening to this is safe and taking care of themselves and not taking any unnecessary risk.
Yeah, no, everybody take care of themselves and hopefully everything will be over soon.
Mm.
Then we can complain about all the other problems in the world.
Right, yeah. We'll complain about our new normal. That'll be something we can hate on. Well, good. So if you'd like to follow Idle Red Hands on Twitter, we're at Idle Red Hands, and you can subscribe to the podcast on any of the popular platforms as well as at idleredhands.com. If you want to support the podcast, consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/idleredhands. And we're also on YouTube and Twitch, doing some occasional live streaming, also doing the video series, the lore series for Mutant Chronicles. So take a look at that. We will be back next week.
Thanks for joining us. Bye.
Bye. Yeah.